Chapter 8, The World of Publishing. In India, I had been accustomed, when not on tour, to devote my mornings to literary work. At the time of my departure for England, I was engaged on a five-part Heritage of Buddhism, which had kept me busy for the last 2 years and was still far from complete. As I did not want to stop working on it, in accepting the Sangha Trust's invitation to spend a few months in England, I had stipulated that I should have my mornings to myself. I had not been at the Vihara many weeks before it became obvious that I would be spending more time in England than I had expected, and that there was no question of my mornings being my own. There were always people to see, lectures to prepare, correspondence to attend to, and the telephone kept ringing. In these circumstances, there was little hope of my being able to produce more than the occasional article. But if it was not possible for me to carry on working on my Heritage of Buddhism, I could at least prepare the first part of it for publication in separate book form and write a short preface. The Heritage had begun as a series of articles for the Aurya Encyclopedia, but I soon realised, my enthusiasm for the Dharma having carried me far beyond the number of words required, that I was writing not a series of articles, but a book, or books. I therefore started looking for a London publisher, and at Lama Govinda's suggestion wrote to Gerald York, the reader for Ryder & Co., then the leading English publishers of books on Buddhism. He replied promptly, and after a few more letters had passed between us, an agreement was signed. As it happened, I met him on the summer school, which he was in the habit of attending in quest of new authors. Gerald York was a cheerful, communicative man of 60 or more, in a tweed jacket and with a briar pipe which he waved around when talking. At the summer school he was to be found of an evening in the Oak Room, where he would hold forth to some of the younger men until quite late, reminiscing about his experiences in China in the 30s and sometimes telling, so I gathered, stories that were not fit for the ears of monks. Not least because I was one of his authors, he took a fatherly interest in me, and in the course of the next few years, I saw quite a lot of him and his wife, both at their London flat and at Fort Hampton Court, their country house near Tewkesbury in Gloucestershire. During one of my stays at Fort Hampton Court, once a residence of the abbots of Tewkesbury, Gerald showed me the house library, which had been started in the 18th century by one of his ancestors, and contained a number of leather-bound volumes that I took the opportunity of perusing. He also showed me his personal library, which was of a very different character. In his younger days, he had been a disciple of the black magician Aleister Crowley, the so-called wickedest man in the world. And the collection was rich in books and, I think, unpublished manuscripts by that strange and complex being, besides other memorabilia. Perhaps because he wanted to see how shockable or unshockable I was, Gerald at one point drew from the shelves a slim, blue-covered volume and asked me to read the little work. It turned out to be a long, stanzaic poem by Crowley in praise of the Virgin Mary, and it had been published by Burns, Oates and Washburn, publishers to the Holy See. It was a rather beautiful poem, I thought, and showed that the celebrated Satanist possessed, among his other talents, an admirable command of metre and rhyme. But before I could finish reading it, my host, with a chuckle, drew my attention to the fact that the first letter of each line of verse, read downwards, spelled out a string of obscenities, very much at variance with the professed character of the work. Crowley had been delighted with the success of his stratagem. Burns, Oates and Washburn, deeply embarrassed, had hastily withdrawn the book from circulation. Jack Austin, a Westminster Bank employee and whilom leading member of the Buddhist Society, had certainly not been a disciple of Aleister Crowley, but he shared the black magician's tastes in at least one respect. He had a marked fondness for what has been called, in disparagement, ecclesiastical millinery. In his case, the millinery was of Japanese provenance, And almost the first thing he did when I visited him at his home in Banstead in Surrey, where he lived with his wife and two young children, was to fling open the doors of his wardrobe and show me his collection of brocade robes. There must have been several dozen of them, of various colours and designs and degrees of sumptuousness, and Jack not only explained to me enthusiastically and at great length who had presented each robe to him and in what circumstances, and when he was entitled to wear it, but paraded back and forth in his favourite items so that I could see how he looked in them. Had he lived in the previous century, he would probably have been a ritualist curate, very much preoccupied with surplices and chasubles, genuflections and incense. Instead, he was a Mahayana Buddhist, living at a time in the history of Western Buddhism when the only robes with which the average English Buddhist was at all familiar were the yellow cotton robes of the Theravadin monk, such as I was wearing, and when the only kind of ordination of which he or she had any real knowledge was monastic ordination. As I knew from our long correspondence, the topic of ordination was a very sensitive one with Jack. He did not want to be a monk, but he desperately wanted to be an ordained person. He wanted to be a Buddhist priest and exercise priestly functions, conducting services, marrying and burying or cremating people, sitting on interfaith committees as the Buddhist representative, and, of course, giving public lectures on Buddhism, of which he had a good general knowledge. Over the years, he had sought ordination in various quarters, at one time receiving from Robert Stuart Clifton, founder of the short-lived Western Buddhist Order, what he believed, wrongly as it turned out, was a Soto Zen ordination. It was on the strength of this ordination that he styled himself, and insisted on being styled by others, the Reverend Jack Austin. But while he was comparatively well known outside the British Buddhist movement, his position within it was ambiguous. He had always ploughed a lonely furrow, and even though this was more by choice than necessity, it was impossible not to admire the energy and pertinacity of his ploughing. In particular, I admired the way in which, year after year, he brought out Western Buddhist, his little magazine of Mahayana Buddhism. Bringing out a Buddhist magazine was not easy, as I well knew. Though now living in England, I was still having to edit the Mahabodhi, the monthly journal of the Mahabodhi Society of India, which was printed and published in Calcutta, and which I had edited for the last 10 or 11 years. Fortunately, I had the assistance of Mrs. A.A.G. Bennett. In her capacity as the Mahabodhi's representative in Europe and the Americas, a post I had created specially for her, she had assisted me for many years. Besides writing for the journal herself and providing news of Buddhist activities in the West, she had translated a number of scholarly articles from German and French, thus helping to give the Mahabodhi a more international flavour. Though she had assisted me for such a long time, and we had exchanged hundreds of letters, relations between us, though cordial, had remained rather formal. Her letters were always signed Adrienne Bennett, and I knew little more about her than what she had revealed in a biographical note which, at my request, she wrote in 1954 for a special number of the Mahabodhi. The note read, "Editor of the Bulletin of the Standing Conference of the Theological and Philosophical Libraries of London. Studied mathematics and physics. Later changed to painting, exhibiting frequently in London. Lived for 14 years in India and China. During the 1939-1945 war, engaged in linguistic work. Then on a history of the development of religious thought. Librarian of the Buddhist Society, London, 1949-1952. Editor of the Middle Way, 1951-1952. Her association with the Middle Way and the Buddhist Society had not ended happily. Her efforts to upgrade the magazine intellectually had been frustrated by Christmas Humphreys's determination to keep it popular. According to Jack Austin, at that time a regular correspondent, There had been a stormy council meeting at which Humphreys spoke to her so brutally that she left the room in tears. The Middleways' loss had been the Mahabodhi's gain, and since it had been my gain too, I was anxious to establish personal contact with our faithful representative in Europe and the Americas and get to know her personally. On visiting her at her flat in Holland Park shortly after my return to England, I found a haggard-faced woman of 60 or thereabouts, wearing heavy makeup and with henna-dyed hair, who was bursting with nervous energy that evidently needed an outlet. It being our first meeting, we naturally talked shop. I was particularly interested in the translation of the Bodhicharya Avatara, on which she was then engaged, and encouraged her to persevere with it, despite the difficulty of the work. At that time, there was only one English translation of Shantideva's classic celebration of the Bodhisattva ideal in print, and this, though very readable, unfortunately was incomplete. The chapter of the Bodhicharya Avatara that had been giving Mrs. Bennett most trouble was chapter 9 on the perfection of wisdom, which Lionel Barnett, the previous translator, had chosen to leave in the obscurity of the original Sanskrit. The perfection of wisdom was the principal subject matter of the Prajnaparamita, or Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, an important body of Mahayana canonical texts that had been translated, almost in their entirety, by Dr. Edward Conser, who had devoted 20 years of his life to the project, thus putting all English-speaking Buddhists very much in his debt. With him too, therefore, I was anxious to establish personal contact. We met in Oxford, that famous home of lost causes, when the Oxford University Buddhist Society invited me to give a lecture under its auspices that autumn. I spoke on the spiritual ideal in Buddhism. Dr. Conser was in the audience, and afterwards the two of us met. This was the first of a number of meetings at his home and at Manchester College, where he taught, and where I once heard him speak on the Madhyamaka school to no more than 20 people, a pitifully small audience for so great a Buddhist scholar. Though he was reputed to have a ferocious temper and people were said to be terrified of his caustic tongue, I never saw the least sign of either. He struck me as being a kindly, even compassionate person. Common friends to whom I mentioned my impression disputed this, but I remained convinced that that was what he was really like. If it is true that as fire drives out fire, so pity pity, then it could have been that his compassion for people's spiritual ignorance at times got the better of his pity for their mundane sensibilities. His, perhaps, was the healing knife that wounded only to cure. Be that as it may, Edward Conser struck me as being not only a kindly person, but also quite a sad one, and indeed he was not very happy at Oxford. When I naively asked him during our first meeting if there was not a good deal of interest in Buddhist philosophy at Oxford, now that he was there, he replied gloomily that there was no interest in it whatever. Oxford philosophers were interested only in linguistic analysis, which was not philosophy in the traditional sense at all. Buddhist philosophy was a lost cause, it seems, even the home of lost causes. There were other reasons for Dr. Conser's unhappiness. Academic Oxford was an exclusive, conventional, and snobbish place, and it was not above humiliating a social and intellectual outsider in mean and petty ways. As Frieda Wint and other Buddhist friends there told me, since Dr. Conser held only continental degrees, he was listed in the University Canada as plain Mr. Conser, and since the lady with whom he was living was not his legal wife, the authorities refused to recognise her existence, and she was not included in invitations to official functions. So far as the university was concerned, Mr. Conser was a bachelor. I met Mrs. Conzer, as she truly was in Buddhist eyes, more than once. The first time was when I had lunch with them at their flat, and Dr. Conzer introduced her in what I thought was a rather offhand manner, simply saying as she walked into the room, "This is Muriel." Did he feel embarrassed, or was he unsure what my attitude would be? Whatever the explanation, it pains me to think that a man of his eminence and distinction should be placed by society in such an invidious position. Years later, having eventually succeeded in obtaining a divorce from his first wife, Dr. Conzer married his Muriel, but by that time he had long severed his connection with Oxford.